From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, comic Mike Birbiglia. He wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film Don't Think Twice. He's best known for his autobiographical stories.
This movie is the first fictional thing I've written. In Sleepwalk With Me, I was jumped through a second-story window. In My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, I was hit by a drunk driver. I mean, how many more of these incidents can I stay alive for?
Also, John Powers reviews a new documentary about cyber warfare.
If history has taught us anything, it's that when a new kind of weapon is created, people will use it, unless you find a way to stop them.
And we talk with David Mandel, showrunner for the HBO comedy series Veep.
Vice President, take it or leave it.
I wouldn't be your Veep if there were a grassy knoll full of Jodie Foster fans in the front row at your inauguration.
Veep is nominated for 17 Emmys. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My first guest is comic, writer, actor, and director Mike Birbiglia. A lot of public radio listeners were first introduced to him through his stories on This American Life. His story about sleepwalking was expanded into his one-man show Sleepwalk With Me, which he later adapted into a film of the same name. Now he's written and directed the new film Don't Think Twice about a comedy improv group. The film's stars include Birbiglia, Keegan-Michael Key, Chris Gethard, and Gillian Jacobs. When the film begins, the six members of the improv group have worked together a long time. They spend a lot of time together offstage, too, and have a strong sense of group identity, until one of them fulfills the dream each of them have had, becoming a cast member on the TV sketch comedy show Weekend Live, the movie's version of Saturday Night Live. They try to feel happy for him, but they mostly feel hurt and jealous and start to question some of their own choices. Let's start with a scene from early in the film when the whole group is still together. They're sitting around the TV, watching Weekend Live, making jokes about how mediocre the show has become. Mike's character, Miles, is the one member of the group who had auditioned for the show in the past and didn't get it.
I'm glad you're keeping score.
It's the sports of comedy. It's the only live sporting event of comedy.
But comedy isn't a sport. It shouldn't have winners and losers, and there shouldn't be points.
They don't have, I mean, they got Gary Cho, and then it's like, who else? You know what I mean? Everybody else is
white.
Even if it wasn't me, there should be somebody else on this show that represents another...
Different shades of white, certainly.
Yes, there's definitely. They've got eggshell.
To ecru.
To off-white. To almost ochre.
Enjoy ochre performers.
Yeah. It was good when I was little.
Right. You never know if it was good when you were little or you were just little so you didn't know. It's the great paradox of Weekend Live is, was it good ever?
And can I,
or did we just think
really,
so because
no,
we
were, you should not have said that in your audition. I think that's
right. Mike Birbiglia, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Thanks, for having me.
In that clip, the whole group, the whole improv group, is watching this Weekend Live show together. But later, when one member of the group actually becomes a cast member of Weekend Live, the rest of the group is watching it. And this time, they're not able to, like, dish it as a group that has never been able to achieve that success. Now, one of them actually made it, and it's kind of upsetting. Would you describe the emotion that everybody's
watching? Yeah, it is kind of
watching,
upsetting, yeah.
Everybody's feeling as they watch one of their own improv members on that show.
You know, that clip that you played is the experience of, I feel like, watching any kind of produced comedy, successful produced comedy show with fellow comedians. It's like you and your friends become sort of the Statler and Waldorf of comedy critics.
They're the Muppets in the balcony.
Yes. And it's not fair at all because so much of it is based on bitterness, I mean, which is sort of at the core of this film is bitterness and jealousy and
resentment.
What happens when your friends make it in a way that you wanted to and maybe you didn't. And then the deflation of the second scene is, it's a mix of emotion. It's like some, you know, in some ways they're like in awe that their friend is on the show. In some ways they're sad that it's not them. And I think that that's a reality of being in show business as well.
You know, you can think, well, that kind of success is out of reach for people like us. But once someone you know has reached that level of success, it's more of a direct rejection. It's like, well, I guess it wasn't out of reach, but it was out of reach for me.
Yeah. I feel like jealousy is this thing that we all foster to varying degrees, and I certainly do.
Chris Gethard, who's one of the stars of the film, he plays one of the improv comics, in your movie has the line, your 20s are about hope, and your 30s are about how dumb it was to hope.
Yeah.
Did you feel that way about your life at any point? I mean, you've done pretty well, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I relate to that to some degree. I feel like there's a way in which when I look back in my 20s, I'm embarrassed because I was, I think, kind of sprawling in every direction looking for any kind of success at all. Kind of like, I'll audition for commercials, I'll audition for voiceovers, I'll audition for movies or TV shows or anything. And I was kind of cast in nothing. And in the kind of... where that crescendoed was when I was about 30 years old. It was 2008. I got my own sitcom pilot with CBS, and I couldn't believe it. And it was like Bob Odenkirk played my brother, and Nick Kroll played my cousin. Like, it was just like in Frances Conroy was, played my mom, and it was like a dream come true. And I thought, oh, this is it. Like, I've made it in a certain way. And then when it didn't get picked up to air, I was crushed. And in that space of time where I, like, my calendar was empty, I decided, well, why don't I go and kind of double down on my own projects? Like, I had been working on Sleepwalk With Me, the one-person show, for 7 years as, like, sort of a side project. And I was like, well, why don't I produce that with the level of production that these networks and studios bring to their movies and TV shows? And so that's when I mounted Sleepwalk With Me off-Broadway, and since then I've made 3 off-Broadway shows and directed 2 movies, and I feel actually so happy for that failure. Like, I feel like that sitcom not being picked up is financially probably the worst thing that ever happened in my life and artistically the best.
Well, tell us more about the sitcom that never happened. Like, what version of your life were you playing?
It was honestly, it was very similar to the sort of Sleepwalk With Me version of myself, which is to say that I was in a relationship on the show with someone who wanted to get married, and I wasn't sure I wanted to get married. I wanted to pursue comedy, and so in a lot of ways, it was the sort of Sleepwalk With Me film narrative, and it was good. It was very much, you know, my version of Seinfeld, my version of Romano, right? Everyone Loves Raymond. Like, it wasn't new, it wasn't original, and I don't know, I'm a little bit embarrassed of it, but it was a good learning process.
So the new movie, Don't Think Twice, opens with, like, the rules of improv.
Sure.
Of those rules of improv, which actually have some meaning for you in the work that you do?
Well, the rules of improv, I believe, are so profound because they apply to almost any kind of collaboration. You know, at the beginning of the film, it says, you know, number one, say yes. 2, it's all about the group. And 3, you know, don't think, which is to say just do, kind of first thought, best thought kind of thing. And I think that those are really good rules for just collaboration. I feel like improv is not my specialty. It's, you know, I would say stand-up and filmmaking is much more my specialty than improv. But it is a thing that I learned when I was 18. And I think that your brain can be imprinted when you're that young with principles that kind of stick with you for a long time. And in retrospect, when I look back on directing Sleepwalk With Me, I didn't know how to direct a movie. There's no way to teach someone how to direct a movie. I mean, you can go to film school, you can direct a short, but to direct a feature film, it's like waiting tables for the first time. You have to sort of lie and say that you've waited tables before, which of course leads to a lot of incompetent waiters who are liars. But directors are like that too. Like, you really don't know what you're doing. And I think in a lot of ways, these ideas, these principles are what got me through. This idea of like, listen to people more than you talk. And yes, and people's ideas. I don't know anything about costume design, but I hired someone whose work I admire. And then I listened to her when she made recommendations. And I said, how does that relate to the concept that I've established? And I think that those are just really great rules for collaboration.
You know, yes, and is one of the principles of improv. Somebody does something and you accept that and you build on it. You add to
sure.
it. Do you do a yes and thing when you're working with yourself, when you're writing and you have one thing you've gotten and you have to figure out where am I going with that? Do you try to apply yes and to yourself?
I think so. I think the way that I do that is when I wrote the movie, I was procrastinating. I had the movie in my head, but I wasn't writing it. But I noticed this trend in my life, which was I was showing up to like lunch meetings or business meetings, but I wasn't showing up to meet myself. And so I wrote a note next to my bed. This is so corny, but I wrote, Mike, exclamation point, you have an appointment at, at Cafe Pedlar at 7 a.m. with your mind. It's so corny. And I would show up. I never didn't show up. And I wrote this movie for spurts of like essentially 3 hours. Like I'd write from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. And the reason I would do that is because I was essentially barely awake, because I feel like that moment at 7 to 10 a.m., you're not afraid of the world yet.
And you'd write at a cafe?
I always write at a cafe.
Why is it?
I recently heard Malcolm Gladwell say that he does that, and I was like, yes, because it made me feel like, oh, okay, like people do that as a thing. I heard him say it, and I think it's the same reason. There are things happening. You're not closed off. You know, there's sound and there's excitement and there's humanity and there's like people interacting with the world. And then you have to stay awake because it's embarrassing to sleep in a cafe. And if you think about it as sort of a prison, like you can't leave and you can shut off your internet. Like I shut off my internet and I try to think in terms, and to your point of like, do you yes and yourself? I think that your own worst enemy as a writer can be yourself. You can write things down and go, no, that's stupid. And I think that what I do at 7 a.m. is like, I don't have that part of my brain operating yet that says no.
You've done a bunch of stories for This American Life. And that's how a lot of people initially found out about you. Ira Glass has done a lot of work with you. He was a producer of your first film. And he's a producer of your new film. You and Ira were on our show after you made Sleepwalk. And on that show, Ira complained about producing. He said, and I quote, I don't understand why people produce movies. You're not doing any of the central creative work. You're not the screenwriter. You don't get the pleasure of really editing. You don't get the pleasure of directing. You don't get the pleasure of performing. You don't get to do any of the fun things. Instead, you're responsible for the entire thing. You're frightened for months that it's not going to work. All you're doing is looking over people's shoulders like a backseat driver driving every part of the process, which is not pleasant. Okay, that is not a ringing endorsement for make me a producer a second time. And yet, he is, again, a producer of your film. So did you have to talk him into it? Did you have to promise him it would be different this time around?
I can't speak to Ira Glass's mental problems. I think that he's... That quote, there's a lot to unpack there. That's definitely his own struggle with self that I think he's dealing with producing his own radio show every week. he's going to love this. He said that a lot of times. He said, I'm never going to produce a movie again. It's, you know, I don't want to do this. I don't get why people do this. I mean, early in the process, like I had like 10 or 12 informal readings at my house, like, of the screenplay, just to get like critical feedback from writers and friends. And Ira would come to them, and early on, like probably the second draft or whatever, he was so furious at the script. He was just like, he's like, Mike, you have to make the characters more different from each other. And that's what I did. I mean, the next sort of seven drafts, I worked on the arcs of the different characters. So him saying, by the way, he's not involved with the creative process. I mean, like, he is so deeply... I listen to every word he says, every criticism that is ineloquently stated and undelicate, not a word. And I take his notes to heart, and he I mean, he's a huge, huge creative force in this film. And of course, he didn't want to do it. And then at a certain point, he was like, well, I guess I'm a producer of this. Like, he wasn't even formally a producer until sort of like days before we shot the film. He was like a friend of the film who would always show up to the readings and give notes and things.
My guest is Mike Birbiglia. He wrote, directed, and co-stars in the movie Don't Think Twice. After a break, he'll talk about becoming a father, and John Powers will review Alex Gibney's new documentary about malware and cyber war. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, providing tools to help people showcase their passions with a customizable landing page, website, or online store. Learn more at squarespace.com/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike Birbiglia. He wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film Don't Think Twice, about an improv comedy group and what happens when one of the members becomes a cast member of a popular TV sketch comedy show, and the other members of the improv group feel jealous and left behind. Birbiglia started his career as a stand-up comic. Many public radio listeners first knew him for his comic autobiographical stories on This American Life. He also wrote and performed in Sleepwalk With Me, an autobiographical one-man show, which he adapted into a book and a film of the same name. So in your book, Sleepwalk With Me, you wrote, "Being a dad has never appealed to me. It doesn't seem like a job you'd apply for." The ad would read, "Screaming child seeks adult man to pay for his entire life. Warning, when the child is 14, he will tell you he hates you and forget about everything you've ever done for him." So how does being a father compare to what you had projected being a father would be like?
I think the first year is hard because you have this, you have a daughter and a wife and you, and it's like you have this thing where you're like, oh, they love each other so much. It's and I'm there too. Like, you're just this third wheel all the time. You're like running around to like get coffee for mom or whatever. Like, you're just an intern for your wife, essentially. And there's something about it that is so pride swallowing. But then also it's you know, you end up closer to your wife than you could also imagine.
Well, the thing with you is your baby was born while you were making your movie, right?
Right before, yeah. I handed in the script to financiers or possible financiers sort of 2 nights before the baby was born, which speaks to how obsessively I plan and try to control the trajectory of my life in the ways that should be disrupted by having a child.
But at some point, I'm sure it was like a bad loyalty test for you, like, what's more important right now, your wife and the baby or the movie?
Oh, yeah. That's ongoing. I try, I will say, like, it throws off kilter a lot of things that you hold dear, like a lot of my living, how I make my living is traveling like a door-to-door salesman to like Cincinnati or San Francisco or Austin, Texas. And now it's so hard to walk out the door, to fly to those places. It's like when you have a baby who's like singing and who's, you know, learning to speak and is, you know, the other day or like in the last month or so, she learned how to say dada. And you know, they say dada early. It's an easy syllable, but like it was the way she said dada, like it's with intent. It's like dada, you know, it's like as though she's requesting something really specific and doesn't realize she's just saying one word. But you can see this intent in her eyes where it's like dada. And I'm like, I don't even know what you want, but I'll hold on to you, or I'll play with you, or take out my guitar and play songs for you, and that kind of thing. Like, you can't, like, there's a level of visceral joy that you experience. I mean, the degree to which my wife and I laugh with our baby, with Una, and Una laughs, that I've never experienced, like, just ever.
So, you have a sleep problem. You are prone to sleepwalking, and the more tired you are, the more likely you are to sleepwalk. So making a movie, being the parent of a baby at the same time.
Yes.
That is absolutely the recipe for not sleeping. So has the sleepwalking been kicking in?
So I guess I won't go to therapy today. we got it covered. Before we had Una, my wife and I went to my sleep physician and talked about, like, what are the logistics of this? I mean, I have this serious sleep disorder, and I could possibly, I mean, I once jumped through a second story window, and I've thrown furniture around the room. And
in your sleep, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my sleep, and which I, of course, talk about in Sleepwalk With Me. And what do we do? Like, how do we do that with a baby? Because so much of raising a child is being up all night with the baby. And he just said, you have to sleep in a separate, he said, you should sleep in a separate room and maybe lock the door from the inside. And so we got this like chain lock from the inside of my bedroom, and then Una and Jen sleep in the other room, which is, you know, you make it work, whatever works. Plus, as I say in the movie, and it's true, I sleep in a sleeping bag up to my neck. I sort of like, you know, lock myself in.
Wow, it's
and I take and I take med- and I take medication. I mean, I'm diagnosed with RBD, so I do all the precautions that people who have RBD take.
That's what REM something.
REM behavior disorder.
Yeah. But that's so upsetting because it's like sleep can turn you into an inadvertently frightening person.
Agreed. Yeah, that's correct.
Well, I'm glad you got it under control. I mean, with the lock and everything, that you have, you know, good advice about what to do.
Yeah, you know, we're trying to face it head on. I mean, like I say in Sleepwalk With Me, REM behavior disorder doesn't have a cure, but ultimately all you can do is sort of acknowledge that it's there and take precautions and face it.
But the great thing about being an artist and comic is that something really difficult like that, you turn it into like a fabulous performance. You turn it into this like you're sleepwalking, you manage to turn it into a story, a one-man show, a book, a movie, you know. Yeah. What I mean? So instead of something that you have to like hide and be ashamed of and feel like you're not worthy, we all have that thing that seems really awful to us. And I don't know, I always feel like when somebody shares that thing that they have, that we can all feel a little bit better about the thing that we have.
So. Oh yeah, no, I completely ascribe to that theory of comedy, and that's in some ways is why I started writing this movie. Is the first fictional thing I've written, because I'm just like in Sleepwalk With Me, I jumped through a second story window, and my girlfriend's boyfriend, I was hit by a drunk driver. I mean, how many more of these incidents can I stay alive for?
So yeah, well, you're leaving out the cancerous bladder tumor when you're a teenager.
And I had a bladder tumor when I was 19. So I'm trying to move into fiction because, it, you know, it's infinite as opposed to my life, which is finite.
Right. Well, that's, yeah, I'm hoping you have no more incidents like that to draw to draw from. But once again, that life-changing experience of having nearly gotten killed in a head-on car accident with a drunk driver, did that feeling of life is short, so like do things, did that stay with you, or did that just kind of fade with time?
I think that it particularly stuck with me when I had a bladder tumor when I was 19. Like, I feel like there was this sense where for about 6 months to a year after they took out the tumor, I thought, I'm going to die. Or, you know, certainly in the days after they discovered it, I thought, oh, I'm going to die. And that feeling sticks with you. And I think there is some sense with my work when I'm when I make something, I'm always thinking like, this could be the last thing I ever make, and so I have to give all of myself to it. So yeah, I think it did have a big impact on me.
Well, Mike Birbiglia, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mike Birbiglia wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film Don't Think Twice, about an improv comedy group. Now we have a review of a new documentary by the prolific filmmaker Alex Gibney. Since his 2005 breakthrough, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, Gibney has made over 25 documentaries, including such recent work as Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine, and Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. His latest film, Zero Days, focuses on the story and large-scale implications of computer malware. Our critic at large, John Powers, says, even if you don't own a smartphone or ever go online, this movie will unsettle you.
When most of us think about computer hacking, we picture Julian Assange leaking government secrets, or a shadowy bad-shaved crook in some former Soviet republic hoovering up credit card info from a chain store. But while folks like these do stir up all manner of trouble, a much deeper danger lies elsewhere. That danger is the theme of Zero Days, a chilling new film by Alex Gibney, who sometimes seems to turn out documentaries as quickly as tweets. This latest one may be his finest and most important, for it doesn't merely tell an exciting story about using a computer virus to wage black ops against Iran. Filled with juicy historical tidbits, it keeps expanding its frame of reference to reveal one of the looming but invisible threats of the digital age. Gibney begins in 2010 in Belarus, where a computer security guy comes across a highly infectious new kind of malware, dubbed Stuxnet, that is dazzling in its complexity. Soon, computer whizzes, journalists, and even the Department of Homeland Security are working overtime to understand this self-replicating virus that takes over every PC it touches. Stuxnet is just too big, too perfect, and too untraceable to be the work of anything less powerful than a national government. But who created Stuxnet, and why? Even today, no country admits involvement. But following the lead of New York Times reporter David Sanger, who broke the story, Zero Days establishes in thorough, sometimes groundbreaking detail, that Stuxnet was a joint project of the United States and Israel, designed to sabotage Iranian attempts to get the atomic bomb. Stuxnet took over computers at Iran's Natanz nuclear plant and directed its centrifuges, which create weapons-grade atomic material, to self-destruct without its technicians being able to do anything about it. This operation was so secret that, well, just listen to Sean McGurk, America's then cybersecurity czar at Homeland Security, talking about the Stuxnet virus.
I've been asked on a number of occasions, did you ever think this was us? And at no point did that ever really cross our mind, because we were looking at it from the standpoint of, is this something that's coming after the homeland? You know, what's going to potentially impact, you know, our industrial control base here in the United States? You know, I liken it to, you know, field battle. You don't think the sniper that's behind you is going to be shooting at you because you expect him to be on your side.
Stuxnet is a great story that brims with great talkers, from Israeli intelligence bosses to NSA employees whose identities must be hidden for their protection. You've got Eric Chien, head of security for Symantec, who's so lucid and charismatic, you'll never call computer guys geeks again. You've got the entertaining Richard Clark, former head of counterterrorism for Presidents Clinton and Bush, who specializes in smiling through his rage. And you have avuncular General Michael Hayden, whose cheery, almost cute manner belies a heart that pumps iron filings. This dude ran both the NSA and the CIA. Zero Days would be worth seeing just for its account of the Stuxnet operation, which boomerangs when Israel pushes things too far, much to American dismay. And Iran does some cyber mischief in the U.S. just to remind us that two can play this game. But Gibney doesn't stop there. He expands his focus, showing that the implications of the story are far huger than one might think. You see, in launching this cyber attack on a foreign country, the U.S. and Israeli governments brought something new into the world. Just listen to General Hayden.
What I said to David Sanger was, I understand the difference in destruction is dramatic, but this has the whiff of August 1945. Somebody just used a new weapon, and this weapon will not be put back into the box.
These days, many countries possess the capacity to wage cyber warfare, taking down the financial system a la Mr. Robot, sowing chaos by seizing control of transit systems, even weaponry, or inflicting deadly damage by shutting down power grids and sabotaging water supplies. Naturally, America has programs in place to do this kind of thing too, which doesn't exactly inspire restraint in our global enemies. If this isn't scary enough, there's no cyber warfare equivalent to the treaties governing nukes and germ warfare. Although President Obama has talked of the need to negotiate international agreements, it's not clear how you monitor a digital weapon that can be hidden on something no larger than a thumb drive. And because all these cyber programs have grown up in the dark, which is how intelligence agencies like them, the public has had little knowledge of, much less influence over, their exact shape and purpose. But after Zero Days, we can no longer say that we haven't been forewarned. Gibney makes it clear that we must start pressing our leaders to negotiate treaties banning it, and to do so before it's too late. After all, if history has taught us anything, it's that when a new kind of weapon is created, people will use it, unless you find a way to stop them.
John Powers writes about TV and film for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Alex Gibney's new documentary, Zero Days. Coming up, we talk with David Mandel, the showrunner for the HBO comedy series Veep. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, providing tools to help people showcase their passions with a customizable landing page, website, or online store. Squarespace also offers domains, hosting, and 24/7 support at squarespace.com/NPR. And from LegalZoom, for over 10 years working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Now that Republicans have concluded their convention and Democrats are preparing for theirs, we're going to talk about one of the most incompetent and self-serving presidents ever.
Ma'am, last night I ran a flash poll on presidential scholars. They have rated you the 43rd most effective president ever.
Out of how many?
44. You were right ahead of James Buchanan, who many feel caused the Civil War.
That's a scene from Veep, the HBO comedy series satirizing presidential politics. It was just nominated for 17 Emmys, including Best Comedy Series. Three of those are from my guest Veep's showrunner, David Mandel, who's nominated as a writer, director, and executive producer of the show. Season 5, which recently wrapped up, was his first season running Veep. He took over from the show's creator, the British writer and director Armando Iannucci. Mandel formerly wrote for Saturday Night Live, Seinfeld, and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Veep stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Selina Meyer, who began the series as vice president. But in season 4, the president resigned and Meyer took over. Hoping to stay in the role she inherited, she ran for president in the next election. Season 4 ended in an electoral college tie. Season 5 focused on the behind-the-scenes calculations and backstabbing as Meyer and her staff tried to win a recount in Nevada and a congressional vote to break the Electoral College tie. There's a moment where it seems that as a result of arcane rules, her vice president, Tom James, may be named president. And although he's become Meyer's rival, she'd want the job in his administration. Tom James is played by Hugh Laurie.
So, Tom, let's be real. You're going to be an accidental president.
Pot kettle.
I'm here to offer my help in making this transition of power as smooth as possible by joining your administration.
Well, strangely enough, I was thinking along the same lines.
Okay, fantastic. I'll tell you what I want. I want Secretary of State, because I think that's the least you can do.
I was thinking vice president.
That's literally the least you can do. And I really want Secretary of State.
Vice President.
Come on. Secretary of State.
Vice President Meyer has got a nice familiar ring to it.
No, it doesn't.
Vice President, take it or leave it.
I wouldn't be your Veep if there were a grassy knoll full of Jodie Foster fans in the front row at your inauguration.
That's a clip from Veep. David Mandel, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the show's 17 Emmy nominations and your 3.
And thank you very much. And congratulations on finding a clip from Veep that you can actually play on the air legally without getting fined
there
by the FCC.
There's so much cursing. There's so much incredibly creative cursing and insulting on your show.
We try.
So when you took over as the showrunner of season 5, the season that just ended, there was a crazy cliffhanger from season 4, which I can't even begin to explain. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to throw the ball to you and ask you about the political cliffhanger.
Season 4, which was kind of part of the reason I took the job, by the way, and I'll loop back to that in a second. But basically, Armando and his team ended the season with Selina running for president against another candidate, a senator by the name of Bill O'Brien. And so it was her and her vice presidential nominee, Tom James, versus O'Brien and his vice presidential nominee, Montez. And basically, it ended in a statistically possible but never happened since the 1800s, an electoral college tie, which basically meant that the election would be decided by the House of Representatives. The sort of wonderful corner that Armando kind of wrote the show into. And so when I first sat down with Julia and HBO and they sort of told me about it and then showed me the scripts and then ultimately showed me the episode, it was sort of this wonderful place because it was sort of, you had no choice but to think of a good idea, but how to get out of this corner. It's sort of, you know, it wasn't just sort of like, okay, so I'm taking over and I got to just do a regular episode. It was sort of like, oh, no, I'm taking over and I have to figure out what happens and how do we get out of this and will she be president and what's going to happen to her?
So let's hear how the scene actually sounded when it played out on TV. And this is Selina Meyer's staff trying to figure out what happens if the election ends in a tie in the electoral vote, as it looks like it's about to do. So they all go on to Google, basically, to see what they're supposed to do, like what happens next, what the protocol is. So here's the scene from Veep.
It's the 12th Amendment.
I have 20th Amendment.
What? Why are there so many amendments? Get it right the first time, people.
It's actually both. 12th is superseded by the 20th. They give the House until January 20th to elect the president.
Each state gets one vote. First candidate to 26 is the new president, and the Senate chooses the VP.
Well, it's a close election with a ton of House races too close to call. What happens if it's a tie in the House?
Right.
Is it a dance-off?
Well, vice president-elect becomes president. Whoever the Senate has picked for VP will be president.
Wait, that means...
That Tom...
What?
...could be the president.
I had literally no idea. It's good to be prepared.
Wait, so you mean that I might lose this election to my vice president?
So we were talking about how you inherited this crazy cliffhanger of an ending. How did you and the writers decide on what the arc of this season was going to be?
Very initially, I guess the easiest way of putting it is I had decided for myself that she needed to lose the election. I felt that the thing that Selina Meyer wants most on all the world is to be elected president of the United States. She was president for a year, but she was not elected. So that was the thing that meant the most to her. And I sort of felt like the character would be ruined if the character got what she wanted. That even though, yes, she would still be petty and occasionally incompetent and all of those things, she would have achieved it. And if she was elected president of the United States, then what are the stakes? Because, yeah, you can go, oh, well, now she's got to get elected for a second term. But she really doesn't. She was elected president of the United States. She won. So I kind of made the decision myself that I would have her lose the election. And then the rest of it was just sort of filling in the journey. So that's how I like to work.
So another development this season is that Selina Meyer, the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character, her daughter, Catherine, decided she's going to do a behind-the-scenes documentary.
Yeah.
Now, the mother and daughter do not get along well. Catherine is always, like, asking her mother for help or asking for a question. And Selina, the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character, is always like, can't you see how busy I am? You know, I have to negotiate a peace treaty or, you know, I have the Secretary of State on the phone. I can't talk with you. And so she's always getting pushed back, and she decides finally she's going to make a documentary. And because everybody is so used to ignoring her all the time, because the staff ignores her too, no one seems to notice that she's running a camera most of the time. And finally, in the next to last episode, we get to see the documentary that she's made. You directed that episode. So you basically directed her documentary.
Yes, I am Catherine.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about what you were thinking when you made that, like some of your process.
It was an idea that as it sort of came together, I loved from the beginning. It was the notion of right in the first episode, we were going to set up this idea that Catherine is making this film. You know, it had been established previously that she had been sort of a film and dance major. We'd sort of heard little bits and pieces. And, you know, Catherine isn't an innocent. I think, you know, Catherine is her mother's daughter. And in some ways, what's the word I'm looking for?
Passive aggressive?
Yeah, passive aggressive is an excellent word. And, you know, with this notion of I'm going to make a movie about this tie, I think there's a rich history of sort of the children of very powerful people deciding that by dint of being in some situation that they were, for lack of a better word, born into, that they are the perfect person to therefore make a documentary about it. But I had this sort of idea, and Eric Kenward was the writer of the episode, and we kind of had this idea that if we could pull this off, the notion that our sort of ninth episode would really be her film, and it would be completely her film, and that it would start with sort of stereotypical documentary beauty shots of DC with ambient nature sounds into the gavel banging, into the revelation that we could tell you the results of this congressional house, a very important thing, buried in this overly sort of super serious Catherine documentary. And it was really fun. And it was really fun because, first of all, we were able to sort of sit and talk with the characters. And we kind of got to dig a little deeper, see little aspects of their lives. That's something that Veep hasn't done a lot of. And that was something that was very important to me. And it also allowed us to kind of go back to scenes that you might remember from the season and kind of show you moments from before them, after them, things you didn't know that were happening. And really, that if you watched this sort of ninth episode and watched Catherine's film, you could almost go back and watch the first eight episodes again and gain perhaps a new appreciation for certain aspects of it. And that was just this overall concept was something I loved.
And because Catherine's mother, the president, the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character,
yes,
is so used to like thinking she can control her daughter. She's always saying to the daughter as the camera's rolling, don't use what I just said or turn it off now. And of course, Catherine isn't obeying her. And so in the documentary,
definitely,
we see all these scenes of the president saying, edit that out, turn off the camera. And the camera's just running.
There were definitely moments where, you know, again, we sort of, you know, in the writing room sort of was like, could this happen? Would this happen? Would they, you know, could this go on like this? And I was very pleased to see the Anthony Weiner documentary. And there were a couple of scenes that seemed almost out of our Catherine documentary of like, everyone clear the room and like, you know, the camera being on and being forgotten about it and whatnot. And it just felt like, yeah, this could happen in a really great way.
So the vice president termed president, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, not only doesn't get along with her daughter, she never got along with her mother. And in this past season, her mother was gravely ill, on life support, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus was called to the bedside to decide whether they should take her off life support or what they should do. And she's kind of torn up about it, you know, tormented about what the right choice is, but really she's thinking about the recount that's going on and what's going to happen with the presidential election, because her ability to stay as president hangs in the balance. And so as she is worried about her mother being gravely ill and what's happening with the recount, her aide, played by Gary Cole, his name in the series is Kent Davidson, takes her aside for a private talk. Let's play that scene.
I don't know if this provides any solace, but ever since your mother's health setback was announced, there has been a